Life Audio.
Hey, welcome to the Happy Ramp Podcast. I am Ted Cluck, joined as always in studio by my good friends, my partner in radio, Ronald J. Martin. Baby, it's just you and me today. We were just off the air talking about all the like kind of financial perks, the windfalls that come our way due to this lucrative partnership that we're in, and just our desire to keep doing radio at a high level. Mm. And you and I get to do that today. And I look at the Happy Rant. I don't know if you're like this, like, you know, stop me if this doesn't resonate. But when I think of great American business stories, I think of Nike and Air Jordans, which we'll talk about. We're going to get to that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then I think of this program.
Yeah.
You know, kind of hard scrabble, started with nothing, made a big financial windfall. You know, now we've kind of, I don't want to say we've tailed off, but, you know, the money is fewer and further between. But yet here we are, baby, on a Wednesday afternoon, just doing radio like the couple of pros that we are. Your thoughts?
Yeah, baby, I know. I mean, you know, I think every great organization, whether it's like sports or business, they go through what's called like the lull. They go through those times where like everything's not clicking. The success they had in the beginning has tapered off, but they're also like readying themselves for like the big comeback, you know?
Yeah.
And well, the only difference with that is I don't see that happening.
Per se, you know, to put a fine point on it. Well, and the thing that's tricky for me is our audience is bigger than it's ever been, but our financials are as low as they've been in 5 to 6 years. So, you know, 100%. I'm no economist. I'm no Alan Greenspan, but I'm having a hard time with that one. But baby, after the break, we're going to talk about a company that has succeeded. We're going to talk about how they succeeded, and we're going to talk about the movie Air, all after this quick break.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-497-4410. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-497-4410. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-497-4410.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
All right, baby. We're back, and you and I both had the experience recently of seeing the new Matt Damon, Ben Affleck movie, Air. Yeah. We alluded to it a couple of episodes ago that we would be seeing it and talking about it. Today is the day that we're talking about it, and I want to get your kind of top-level reaction, and then I have some like questions about your experience with the movie that will bounce off some of my experiences with it. So like, I think you're... assessment of the picture was very much like mine. And what was it?
So, yeah, we typically line up pretty well when it comes to like sports movies or sports influence movies, which this would be one of those. This is not really a sports movie at all, to be honest. Mm-hmm. But, so my take, my hot tea on it was, it was not great, but it was entertaining.
Yep. That's exactly where I was on it. It was a super fun 2 hours. I took KK, I took Maxim. We all had a great time with it. It was a blast, but it wasn't great. And I felt at times that it was striving so hard to be Moneyball and or Jerry Maguire. And it kept falling short. And I have a theory as to why that is. And then I have a specific music thing. So at their essence, Moneyball and Jerry Maguire are both character studies, right? And they're both these really deep character studies that for the top like 2 to 3 characters in the movie, they really invite you to get inside that person's head and know the person. Yeah, so like you think about Jerry, you think about Rod, you even think about Dorothy Boyd and Jerry Maguire or You know, Peter Brand and Moneyball, kind of the secondary character. You're really getting to know the psyches of these people. Whereas to me, it felt like Air was just, well, first of all, it was a movie about a meeting, mm-hmm. right? So it was a movie about getting a meeting to happen mm-hmm. and then having the meeting, which is kind of a big swing, but it was so plot driven. I felt like I didn't get a chance to know any of the characters. Do you have yeah. thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that because I think, I you know, even like even the way you framed it, T, like a movie about a meeting, there's something actually like almost brilliantly creative and compelling about that in a weird way.
I agree.
Yeah. So like saying that doesn't denigrate how great it could have been. You know what
right.
I mean? But
yeah.
but I do think that it was this is the sense I got, man. I really want to hear your yeah. take on this because
yeah.
I got because leading up to the movie, I don't know if you caught any of the interviews between Affleck and Damon. And so what you
a
have
couple.
Is you have two like best buds who formed mm-hmm. a brand new like film company, made this movie. But I got the sense that it was like the kind of project where they couldn't stop cracking up as they were shooting all the scenes. And
yeah.
it was almost like because of that and because they're so close, I felt like that kind of tipped into sort of some of the lack of character development because it felt like very inside jokey to me. It felt almost like
yeah.
no pun, but like inside basketball
yeah.
a little bit.
Yeah.
Almost like
yeah.
they were like, hey, check it out. We're like these two guys. We get to make a movie. It's going to come out on a large scale. But if we're not careful and if we don't spend enough good time and attention on it, this thing can
yeah.
end up just being two best buddies making a movie together on a large scale. And that's sort of how it felt to me in some ways.
That's a fascinating take. I had a little bit of a different take on why it didn't work. To me, it felt like a too many cooks in the kitchen movie.
Oh, dude,
you know
I
what
agree
I mean?
With that. I agree
where
with that.
Like,
yeah.
and I learned all this the hard way, like making, you know, my tremendous failure of a movie so far. Hopefully, the story's not over. But I feel like I made every mistake you can make while making a movie, and one of them was just the realization. And you know this from your career in music, okay? So like every time you set out to do a creative endeavor. Every additional person that you bring on, person or entity, either financially or creatively, every person like that you bring on changes the project.
Mm-hmm.
And so with Air, you had these multiple plates spinning of, I'm sure Nike was involved. I know that Michael Jordan was involved due to some interviews that I listened to.
Yeah.
And Jordan had some really good demands and he had some less good demands. And the great one that he had was... He was adamant about Viola Davis playing his mother, and I thought she was great.
She was great, yeah.
Yeah, her scenes were terrific.
It was technically, I mean, sorry to cut you off, but it was like, yeah. you could say Air was a movie about a meeting, or you could say Air is the movie about Michael Jordan's mother played by, yeah, so.
I mean, it really was.
Yeah.
And honestly, if they had leaned into that more, it may have had more juice, but... Air to me seemed like a movie made by a committee. You know what I mean? And it was a good committee. Like everybody on the committee was smart, but there were too many people. Whereas Jerry Maguire feels like Cameron Crowe's vision, you know? And it was Cameron Crowe's movie.
100%.
It had all the Cameron Crowe beats. It had the tenderness and the heart of Cameron Crowe. And I think when you get too many people involved in telling a story, you lose some of that. Because Sonny Vaccaro in real life was way more interesting than the Sonny Vaccaro that we saw in the movie.
Mm.
So they just didn't do much with that character. I thought Jason Bateman was great, kind of dialing it up as the 80s kind of shallow marketing guy. That was fun.
Yeah.
I loved his scene where he was talking about his divorce.
Yeah.
That was where like that was the one scene where the movie had some heart.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
or even Phil Knight kind of leaning into him being like a Zen Buddhist, like, scumbag materialist would have been interesting. Like, if we'd gotten more on that. But they were kind of trying to get everybody touches, and it just didn't work.
Yeah, no, I agree. I thought, you know, all Jason Bateman has to do is act like Jason Bateman, and he's one of the most likable
yes.
guys in Hollywood.
So yeah,
he maybe has, like, an acting career where he hasn't had to act ever
yeah.
in his life. He just shows up and... Because you get the sense that in real life, he's literally that guy, you know?
Yeah,
he's
dude.
He's one of those rare actors, you know?
So let's do 30 seconds on that, because I know you're a student of charisma and you're a you're a great, like, Vince Vaughn aficionado like I am. Like, I would say that they're similarly charismatic.
Yeah, I would agree.
But also differently charismatic in that, like, if you were at a party with Jason Bateman and he was doing Jason Bateman things, you'd love it. And Vince Vaughn would be the same way.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, they're a little bit different, you know? But it kind of hits me at the same level where it's just like, I leave a Jason Bateman experience going, I wish there were more scenes with that guy.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
No, I felt the same way. Because every time, I'll just say this, man, like every time Bateman came into the scene, I was happy he was coming into the scene.
So yeah, totally.
I was looking forward to it. And here's the thing. I really like Damon, too. So Damon Damon is, you know, I have watched things with Damon where I've looked at him going, he's not a great actor, and he's trying really hard in this movie to act. And
yeah.
So that was not this film. This film kind of suits who Matt Damon is as an actor.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
I feel like in a way, this was a film where Matt Damon was needing to act like Jason Bateman. And
yeah.
He just doesn't have that either, you know?
Yeah.
So it wasn't a bad role for Matt Damon. It was a better role for Jason Bateman. Now on that, To me, the guy that looked like he was the most miscast and the guy who looked like he was acting was the least believable character to me was Ben Affleck.
Yeah, it was a misuse of, actually a misuse of all those guys. So if this were a basketball analogy, it would be like having Jordan on your team, but, you know, making him pass the ball seven times before he shot
right.
or whatever.
Yeah,
it was
right.
just
no,
100%. Like, you had a lot of talent on that roster, but to some degree, everybody was miscast by like one guy. So let's think about this for a minute. I think the real life Sonny Vaccaro was kind of a wildly charismatic scumbag. That would have been perfect for Bateman. So you slide Bateman into the Vaccaro role, you minimize or kind of get rid of the Rob Strasser role altogether, or give it to Damon or give
mm-hmm.
it to Affleck.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have somebody else entirely playing Phil Knight. I don't know. I think it might have worked better because I had the same feelings about Affleck, and I love Affleck. Like,
yeah.
I'm so pro Affleck. I love The Town. I love Argo. Like, late career Affleck has been tremendous.
But that's funny what you just did, because you just mm-hmm. arguably listed easily the best two things he's ever done. Right?
Yeah, that's true. That is
so
true.
I think he's a guy that has had a ton of missteps. You know what I
yeah.
mean? And I don't think I don't even think he's an incredible actor. I just think he has to be cast so right for him
yeah.
to work. And you just named maybe the two movies that he was cast the most right of all time.
Well, and here's what's interesting, okay? You take those two movies and you take Good Will Hunting, and all three of those characters are very similar.
Yeah, well, that's true.
They're all three kind of loyal caretakers,
right?
Right. And there's some risk involved, but they're taking care of somebody. And I think Affleck has this ethos that's real. Like, there's some tenderness and some approachability there, and there's some trust there. And, you know, to have him just playing like a kind of disingenuous, you know, dirtbag who's saying like Zen Buddhist things and then ogling his secretary. I don't know. I didn't like him there.
I just couldn't buy him. He looked like he was dressed up for Halloween.
His
getup.
The purple sunglasses.
The whole thing was like you guys were alive in the 80s. Why are you like doing this thing like this is what you thought the 80s looked like? You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's right.
It was so over the top, you know? I mean, these guys are my age, right? They literally grew up in the same era as I did, you know? And I think the scene that disappointed me the most, since we're on this, I think it was the sort of like just that 5-minute interlude when they all finally got into the boardroom for the meeting, and you had Affleck showing up late, and then the guy saying, you know, show the film, don't show the film, and this awkward kind of back and forth dialogue. I thought that was so unbelievable. Like, I thought, how did you not watch this take and like redo it or rethink it?
I'm glad you said that.
It was so weird to me. It made no sense to me because
I had such high expectations for that scene.
Yes, so
because the whole movie had been building toward
that's the scene.
My gosh, they got the meeting.
That's
you know,
the
and the meeting,
the meeting
is going to be that was going to be like the Scott Hatterberg home run game or the Rod Tidwell gets knocked out and then wakes back up game.
I mean, 100%, yes.
You know, it should have been that game in a sports picture.
Yeah, it was
but
so
instead,
awkward.
It was really jagged, really awkward. It was almost like they were over budget and that was the last scene that they had to shoot. And they shot it in like a half a day, you know, yeah. And they really needed like 4 days to shoot it. It was very jagged and it overpromised and underdelivered in major ways. Let's take a break, baby. And on the backside of the break, I've got a couple other questions I want to ask you. We'll be back. All right, baby. I've got some specific ones now.
Yeah.
I want to start with this. How did you feel about them not showing Jordan? I thought it was brilliant. I'll get into why in a minute, but I want to hear how you felt about it.
Okay, I actually loved that, did you hear the interview from Affleck on why they did it that way? Did you hear him talk about it?
I did not. No, yeah. What did Affleck say? I'm fascinated by what.
So Affleck said. Affleck said. He said because somebody asked him that. They said, "Dude, it's so weird. You know, never showed his face." And he said, "Look," He goes, he's so iconic. He goes, unless we actually had Michael Jordan and he could have been like 40 years younger or whatever he is, you know?
Yeah.
He goes, it just would have been cheesy. It just would have been, we get the actor to play Jordan. It's not Jordan. It's a guy sort of looking like Jordan. And he said to us, it just would have lacked so much legitimacy. We just thought it was a better move to just show his backside the whole time.
I think that was brilliant because I think Jordan is one of the five most charismatic people on earth right now. Like, he is 99th percentile good looking. He's incredible with the media. He just has a presence that you can't capture it. Like, there's no chance. And I think the way they did that was really smart and really tasteful. And I really liked
it. I agree. It was a good move. If you hadn't like seen that interview, it kind of, you almost like were waiting for them to find, like, when are they going to show Jordan's face or get his reaction? Yeah. They never do. So they kind of leave that hanging, which again, it was a really brilliant, like, movie making move.
I agree. And I love that they didn't try to recreate any basketball.
All the basketball
that was shown was like found footage from the era that it came from. That was brilliant.
Yeah. It was all accurate.
Yeah, it was. So there were some aesthetic things that the picture got really, really right. Okay. What was your favorite 80s thing? Because I know you love the 80s. I love the 80s too. Even though they were dialing it up and really going for it and going kind of cartoonish and over the top, I just enjoyed like the office buildings, the vending machines, the cigarettes, the like the 7-Eleven that he stopped in multiple times. Like the Porsche, even though the Porsche was ridiculous, I love that like era of Porsche. I don't know, all of it, the pagers. The bag phones, like all of that
pager hanging off of Damon the entire time, because that was literally what it was.
That was what it was, dude. You had a beeper, you know,
and
if you got beeped, you like you took it off your belt and you held it up and you kind of regarded it in a certain way. And it's just like a cultural anthropology thing that we don't have anymore. And even just like, I think in the movie they called it the bullpen, but like the office aesthetic of, you know, you're at work. And if you're kind of an important executive, you have an office that kind of like is on the outside, like rim of the building. And then inside, there's just all these dudes at desks. And like some of them are playing video games and some of them are like shooting wadded up pieces of paper at waste baskets. And that's like an 80s movie trope that I love.
I know.
Because like nobody even goes to an office anymore. Everybody works remotely. And it's like we don't even have office buildings.
Yeah, no, I love that.
I thought that
was
really nice. What was your favorite 80s thing?
I love the beepers. I loved the old school big tiny box computers with the green graphics. Scattered all over the office. I mean, there's something so nostalgic about that. I mean, I was too young to work in an office at that time, but it was like to be able to look at that was like really, really great. You know what I loved, man? I loved every time they walked into Nike, there was that big neon like Nike like sign. Just like, I loved that, man. I loved how nostalgic that was because it felt like walking into an old 80s mall because that's how everybody's signage was. Everybody's store sign was like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, that's true. You know what I really enjoyed too? Like by way of exposition that I think the movie did well. I enjoyed how they they gave like the 2 minutes of kind of sneaker history and like what the industry was like in the 80s, you had Converse was kind of the old guard in the basketball shoe market because they had Bird and Magic and Isaiah. And then you had Adidas, who was this German company, but everybody loved the tracksuits, and everybody all the kids wanted to wear Adidas. And even though I remember that being true and I grew up in that, it was an interesting reminder because Nike has been so on top for so long. You kind of forget that they were the hard scrabble, like try hard guy back in 1984.
Well, see, like, dude, I wouldn't, you know, so I really wouldn't have known that. So, mm-hmm. like, I, you know, to learn that history of it, I thought was super interesting and fascinating. And to be mm-hmm. honest, I almost would have liked them to sprinkle a little bit more of that through the film. I think that would have been really, because I wasn't aware that, like, you know, Nike didn't like own the basketball division, you know, back then. I had no clue. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, you know, I really liked that. I liked learning about all that. I thought that was cool.
I like it too. Dude, did you ever see the Steve Prefontaine track movie that starred Billy Crudup from Almost Famous?
No.
It's pretty cool. And it engages.
When did it come out?
It came out in like 2000, you know what I mean? So it like, I didn't see it in real time because I was busy being, I don't know, young and trying to get established and all that stuff. So there was like a 5-year stretch where I didn't see any movies, but like, it's really interesting because it engages sort of the decade and a half of Nike that like immediately precedes this movie. So Prefontaine was this preternaturally gifted and charismatic track star at the University of Oregon. Mm. And he was kind of a rebel. He was kind of like a James Deanian figure. But Phil Knight, and so Phil Knight has this interesting history of like hitching his wagon to charismatic people. So Phil Knight sees Steve Prefontaine compete because Knight ran at Oregon too, like a iteration before Pre. And so he sees Prefontaine and he's like, I've got to make this guy the face of my running shoes. Okay. So he starts making running shoes. He starts like taking these trips to China, making running shoes, getting Prefontaine to wear them. Prefontaine's winning races all over the place. And he either goes to the Olympics or is about to go to the Olympics, and he dies in a car accident.
Really?
So yeah, he died young, but he was really like the energy behind the first iteration of like Nike running shoes becoming a thing. And then the company was sort of without a face for a little while. And then Jordan came along in 84 and picked it all up. But I actually think the Prefontaine movie is a better movie.
Really?
I think it's just a better movie. The storytelling is better. You know, I think you'll like it. If you see it, let me know and we'll discuss it on the air.
And what's it called again?
I think it's called Pre, but there were two Prefontaine movies that came out. So let me just in my studio Google it really, really quick. But Billy Crudup, Prefontaine movie. It's called Without Limits. And it actually came out in 1998. Okay. It was a 1998 thing.
Wow.
Yeah. So if you watch it, you'll enjoy it. And that was kind of in Billy Crudup's Apex Mountain, you know.
He was doing
Almost Famous right around that time, and
yeah,
he had a lot of juice for sure.
Yeah,
but
that's fascinating.
Yeah, it really is. I have another specific question for you. How did you feel / did you notice when they literally stole the exact song from Jerry Maguire, and it was like early third act, they played one of the songs from Jerry Maguire.
I did not notice that. Which one?
I don't know the title, dude, but if you heard it, you would know it. And I'll find it and like send it to you off the air. But
okay.
It was one of those iconic Jerry Maguire like bridge songs where I don't know, it'd be playing during the scene where like Jerry and Dorothy Boyd are like cleaning up the beer bottles after the wedding reception, or where like Jerry right. Maguire's waving goodbye to Dorothy Boyd as she like drives her moving van out of town for that minute or whatever. And it was that kind of song, and it was just what it was on screen when like they were waiting for the meeting to happen and Vaccaro was like, I don't know, sleeping on the couch or whatever.
So it's just kind of one of those iconic 80s.
Yeah,
like hard rock songs, or
it was one of those like Nancy Wilson kind of instrumental like bridge songs that Jerry Maguire used. But it's a really good song. Like, I really enjoy the song a lot. But it kind of shocked me that, like, the movie was trying so hard to be Jerry Maguire. And it's so much so that it stole the track from it, you know? I thought that was strange.
Did you find it on that? Mm-hmm. I'm just thinking about this right now. Because there was absolutely... I mean, there was no like burgeoning like romance.
Anymore. Yeah,
it was completely absent. So there was no love interest. There was no like Matt Damon. You know, there's the other person working in the office, and they end up working together, and they end up getting this deal. Because I guess that's not really what happened, but still, they didn't incorporate anything like that.
Even in Moneyball, you had the scenes with the ex-wife, and you had the scenes with the daughter. That kind of gave it a little bit of a heart, you know?
100%, right. Yeah, the whole thing. I mean, technically, the movie is about Brad Pitt deciding not to leave his daughter behind.
That's right, you know? Yeah.
I mean, literally, that's the movie.
Yeah, I'm going to give up winning a World Series to stay in Oakland where
I'm going to give up $12 million and a World Series to stay close to my daughter.
It's a really tender premise. Like, it's really nice. And, like, those scenes of tenderness where you get Brad Pitt being a father...
Yeah.
And he's like, you got her a cell phone. It's a pretty big parenting choice, you know, and like just stuff like that. Like it gives you this sense of, he really cares. And you had no sense that any of these guys had families or significant others or like anything going on.
It was not a part of it at all. It's funny.
Yeah. And the closest you got, and I want to hear you on this, was Jordan's mom. Who was this kind of like Machiavellian figure where she's the cutthroat, like Gordon Gekko figure, like pulling the strings and making all the deals in the, you know, in the shadowy wings of his career. I guess even with all the Jordan like folklore that I've consumed over the course of my life, I hadn't known that. That was interesting.
Yeah, I had no clue. Yeah, I had no clue. I was kind of fascinated by that. I mean, the fact that she knew exactly what she was doing too.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Like the business instincts.
Uh huh.
On this woman who was just like a housewife from like rural, you know, lower middle class North Carolina. She just had it. Like she was born with it. And even knowing that, like, we want back end on the shoe that has his name on it.
That was unbelievable.
Unbelievably brilliant. And it gave him so much leverage. Yeah, it was just remarkable. And I guess I didn't know any of that.
Yeah, I didn't know that phone call turned him into just, like, a billionaire mogul.
That's right. You know? But that being said, she wasn't exactly a sympathetic, relatable character. And... they tried to frame her as such, but it really didn't work. She was very like Gordon Gekko, you know? Mm. I don't know. And her scenes were fun. Like maybe my favorite scene of the movie, and I want to hear your favorite scene, was when Damon flies to North Carolina, rents the car that has the bag phone in it.
Yes.
I loved the car. Yeah. I loved the steering wheel. I loved the bag phone. It was like a Chrysler K car, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
And he drives it out to their house, and he has those couple minutes of like really human banter with Jordan's dad.
Yeah.
And then she brings him around to the backyard, and they have their sparring session over that like, you know, wooden picnic table in the backyard. That scene really crackled for me. I thought it was really good.
Yeah, I mean, I can't disagree with that. I mean, that was easily my favorite scene. I loved that. Yeah. I loved the dad and the mom, and they're just showing them as being just everyday people.
Yeah.
Who had like this extraordinary son with this off the chart like gift.
Yeah.
And yet, I mean, he's still working on the car, and she's coming out after cleaning the kitchen, and it's like, hey, we're calm, we're collected. We know that this kid, we already know the kind of future he's going to have, but we also know that we want him making the right decisions, and we are the ones in charge of that right now.
Yeah. Yeah, you know? That's right.
It was so cool, calm, and collected. And I love Damon coming in going, dude, I am walking a tightrope right now.
Yeah.
But this can all go so bad for me. So bad.
It could go so bad, and yet he played it right. Like he said the right things, and I loved the couple minutes where, and they did this well visually on the screen too, because you had that couple minutes where Damon's like, all right, he's like, this is what Converse is gonna say, And then they cut to that, like, actually happening. And he's like, this is what Adidas is going to say. And I think that really resonated with Jordan's mom. And I don't know if that's how it went down in real life, but it really worked well as a movie scene.
I thought that was such a... That, to me, was, like, really classic scene.
Yeah, it was great. It was great.
For sure.
Baby, what's your relationship with, like... I know you like shoes. I really like shoes, too.
Yeah.
What's your relationship with Jordans? Like, the Jordan brand? Like, do you care about that at all or get excited about them or...
Well, baby, check it out. So I don't at all.
Yeah.
I'm an Adidas Converse guy, ironically enough. And
yeah, right.
Those are the two really just the only brands I ever buy. And but I had a buddy of mine who's a big Jordan guy, big basketball dude. And a couple of years ago, maybe 3 years ago, like, he bought me a pair of Jordans for my birthday.
Uh-huh.
And he's a dude, he's a good friend of mine, lives in Baltimore, and he just sent me a box.
Yeah,
and I had no idea, you know. So I'm like, I'm getting this package in the mail. I open it, and it's a pair of Air Jordans, and I don't even know the dude sent me up. Like, I don't know who it's from.
Yeah.
It's coming from Nike. You know what I mean? So he sent them from Nike, you know, kind of a thing.
Yeah.
And I kind of put two and two together and figured out it must have been him. And I was like, dude, what did you do? And he goes, dude, everybody should have a pair of Jordans.
Huh.
And he got
That's
me
fascinating.
The and he got me the old school, like. You know, the old school, the original, like, retro Jordans.
Yeah, the Jordan 1s, man.
The
which
Jordan
were
1s.
Beauties.
That's what he got me. And so he got me a pair of, like, red, I'm sorry, like, blue, not the Bulls colors, but, like, the blue and white and blue, black, and white. And, and dude, I got to be honest with you. There are horribly uncomfortable shoes.
Yeah, they really are. They're not great,
they're
are they?
Crazy uncomfortable. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, they're stiff. Like, they're not super padded. Like,
they're not. Yeah.
The shoe has gone... I'm wearing a pair of Adidas right now. I've got a pair of Adidas basketball shoes on, and they're, like, the most comfortable shoes.
Yeah, they're, like,
I've ever
beautiful, right? Yeah, they're, like, modern. They're, like, modern, and they're all right. You're right. They're designed with comfort in mind and playability in mind. And
yeah, comfort, playability, function. Yeah, but they still look really nice. Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting, like, evolution of a product. There was a scene in, I don't know if, did you watch The Last Dance? Those Jordan documentaries.
I did.
I loved those, dude.
Yeah, it was good.
And there was a scene in there where apparently, like, later in his career, Jordan decided to play a game and, like,
I
the
know.
Original Jordan 1s, and they like, tore his feet up. Yeah,
I know.
Exactly.
Well, dude, like, I wore these, so I wore, like, I did the business casual, like, suit thing for Easter with my Jordans, you know?
Yeah.
And, dude, my feet were it was one church service. My feet were killing me after.
Yeah, you felt like you had played an NBA game.
Literally.
Like, standing around in those for 30 minutes.
Literally, know? Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's funny. About The Last Dance, I'll say this and then we'll draw to a close. Because you and I are of like mind in terms of if we're getting very little money, we're going to do very little work. my favorite thing, maybe my favorite thing about The Last Dance was any scene that had Jordan getting, like, out of a vehicle and having people respond to him. You know what I mean? So, like, those scenes of he's getting off the bus in Paris, he's wearing, like, the little beret, and he's just kind of sauntering about, and people are just beside themselves that he's there.
Like, he is God.
I could have watched... I could watch, like, 8 hours of those scenes just cut together in a row. And I don't know why, but they do something for me. You know, really interesting.
It's fascinating. I'll tell you what fascinates me about like documentaries like that, when they show a bunch of, like, you know, actual footage and stuff.
Yeah.
What I love is I'm always looking at the people working behind the scenes that don't care that he's Jordan.
Yeah. So I love, that's interesting.
I love when he's walking down the hallway of, like, whatever the stadium he's at. I don't know.
Chicago Stadium. Yeah.
There you go. And you got, like, the guy that's been the janitor there, like, before Jordan was even there, just doing his thing, barely looking up at Jordan. Not because he's in awe, but because he's just trying to do his job, and it literally means nothing to him.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I just love that. I love that so much.
I love contextual fame things like that.
Yeah.
And you take Jordan, who, even at that time, was probably the most famous person on the planet.
I mean, no doubt.
And there are X number of people in his life who just don't care, you know?
Literally
and
don't care because they see him every day.
That's as it should be. It's normal,
see him every day.
Right? Yeah. Like, and if they play 82 games a season and 41 of those are at home, like, Yeah, if you're the janitor, you're seeing him all those days at practice and all those days for games, and it's not a big deal anymore because it's literally not a big deal. You know,
he's just a dude.
He's just a dude who, was very gifted at one thing. But yeah, fascinating stuff, baby.
I love it.
You know, we've experienced a little bit of it. I mean, we get out of the car at these venues. I mean, and it's going to be the same in Indianapolis when we do our live show in September. We're gonna get out of that car, and people are regarding us a certain way, and you know,
It's hard. It's hard.
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard to deal with sometimes, but. You know, it's the particular kind of burden that comes from fame at this level, you know,
100%.
And you make your peace with it.
It's what we make our peace with it. It is the burden that we carry, you know.
It really is. Yeah. And you know what though, we do it for the people, and we do it for you people. We do it for the audience. We will have more details about our live show in Indianapolis.
I was going to say, baby, that's a soft announcement. You just like,
that's a soft announcement, dude. I'm rolling it out there, but there are going to be tickets. There are going to be tickets pre-sold and available for our venue.
And they're not going to be cheap. They're
not
going to
be cheap, dude. This is an elite event. This is a high end night out in Indy. I'll say this about it, baby. That Soma Church is my all-time fave venue where we've ever done a live thing.
Yeah,
I think
agree.
It's the perfect room. I love the room. I love the church. I love the people there. There are some people at that church that are like connected to the college where I went, and it's always fun to see them.
It's going to be great.
It's in the neighborhood that I used to live in. So,
is that right?
Yeah, well, like all cities nowadays kind of call this area of town Midtown, but the term Midtown didn't exist back then.
Mm-hmm.
It was just like... It was the part of town that was in between downtown and the suburbs. Like, it definitely wasn't the suburbs, but it definitely wasn't, like, downtown. We had an awesome apartment there. We spent an incredible 2 years of our early married life in that area, and I just love it. It makes me deeply nostalgic. I can't wait to be there again. In fact, my side project is I'm trying to Airbnb an apartment in my old apartment complex. And you know how Airbnb doesn't get super specific with like addresses and stuff. So I'm trying to moneyball this thing and get into my old complex for like peak nostalgia. But we'll see if I'm successful.
Like just for fun, just to stay like a weekend kind of a thing.
Yeah, for around the show though. So like do
the show. Okay.
Yeah, do the show and then I drive back to like, you know, our old complex.
Yes.
Gosh dang, that would be awesome, dude.
Yeah, that would be sweet.
In fact, it would probably be crappy, and I'd probably be annoyed by how.
Yeah, you're going to be like, "This is the worst idea I ever had."
Yeah, loud and not nice it was, but for now, it seems like an incredible idea. So we'll see if we can pull it off, baby. We have pulled off another episode of Radio Magic for our listeners. We've done what we always do. We've wandered to and fro, and until next time.
We want to take a moment to thank the team at Life Audio for partnering with us on this podcast. Be sure to go to lifeaudio.com and take a look at the other podcasts in their network. They've got shows about prayer, Bible study, parenting, and more.
Hi, I'm Beckett Cook, host of The Beckett Cook Show. I lived as a gay man in Hollywood for many, many years until I had a radical encounter with Jesus 13 years ago. Since then, I've gotten my master's degree in seminary and published a book called A Change of Affection. On my podcast, The Beckett Cook Show, I sit down with fascinating Christian scholars and thinkers to address the lies of the culture and bring the biblical truth to bear on those lies. To start listening now, go to lifeaudio.com or search for The Beckett Cook Show on your favorite podcasting platform.